Under the skin. Hello and welcome to Under the Scales. The Under the Scales mobile studio, as I like to say, has moved to New York City, well north of my home in Princeton, New Jersey, and I'm here with Andy Bernstein. How are you, Andy?
I'm doing well. How are you, Tom?
Doing fantastic. Now, I've known you for a long time over the years, and you have a record with Phish, which also goes back. You've done lots of different projects with Phish, some of them pretty high profile. And I often tell people, you know the subject of my interview, but you don't know how you know him. But in your case, I think people know how they know you. And I'll give that one away right away. You're the founder of Headcount, which is getting people to vote. So lots of people know you from that.
Yeah, it's we are nearly 14 years into Headcount. We started late 2003. Myself and Mark Brownstein of the Disco Biscuits started it. And it's kind of mind-blowing where it's gone. We've registered about 500,000 people.
That's amazing.
We've done voter registration drives at like well over 5,000 concerts, including all 13 Baker's Dozen, which was a lot of fun. And the thing that I'm really proud of is just kind of our community and our volunteers. We have 20,000 volunteers in our database. And among those, there's just a real core group that are some of the most amazing people I've ever met. And we all get to know each other and work festivals together and tours together. And I'll start any conversation about Headcount with just talking about the people who really made it happen. And I've
right.
gotten to have a lot of fun and gotten a lot of credit, but it's the, just the kind of the people are out there with clipboards talking to people about voting and why it's important to make your voice heard. They're the ones who are making it happen. And a lot of them are Phish fans. A lot of them aren't.
Right.
But we took what we knew about the grassroots music community and tried to apply it to politics and participation. And it's here we are. We're still doing it. So it must have worked.
That's great. And in an effort to stay chronological, just so my mind stays organized, let's start, you know, at the beginning, if you don't mind, and then we'll kind of wrap up with Headcount, which to me is sort of like the cherry on the top of your life, so to speak.
Sure.
At least your Phish life, as I know you. You might have other important things in your life. But the first time I believe we met, you were involved with something called the Farmer's Almanac. Is that right? Or we may have even met prior to that.
I think it was after the Almanac. Yeah, it was 95. I mean, one of my really cherished memories is that we had come out with the Farmer's Almanac in fall of 95. And it was very DIY and printed 1,000 copies. And we're, you know, just at the shows moving them. And we get a call on our answering machine, not even voicemail. It says, hey, this is Tom Marshall, the lyricist for Phish, and I was backstage with the band checking out your book, cracking up, and I want to know if I can get some more copies. And I still remember that so well. And we just looked at each other, my roommates who were the co-authors, and it was really one of the great moments. And it's, you know, it's why you do a book like that, too.
Oh, well, I'm happy to have provided that moment for you guys. I wasn't aware of that. I do sort of remember making that call. I was backstage with Phish, I guess, and we were cracking up. So we should tell a little about what the Farmer's Almanac was at that time. So what was I holding in my hands, most likely, Andy?
So what it was at the time, it was a very short, it was a compendium of both stories and reviews about Phish and the history of the band and set lists. And my partner, we had a few partners, a couple guys I grew up with, Brian Celentano and Larry Chasnoff, which is a name that more people will know later on. And then a guy named Lockhart Steele. And Locke has gone on, not only does he have the coolest name ever, let's just acknowledge that. His name is Lockhart Steele, it's real.
He's famous now for the Steele dossier.
He is famous for being the founder of Curbed and Eater. So Locke has done incredibly well.
Okay.
But
now my thing was incorrect, fake news. Your thing is correct.
It actually is real.
Yeah, those are awesome internet companies.
Yeah, a Phish fan started Curbed and Eater.
That's cool.
And I met Locke at college. I went to Brown University And I started listening to Phish. My first real show, I saw a Horde show in 1992 at Jones Beach. I remember walking in and a band was playing and I said, oh, these Phish guys, they're great. Only it was Widespread Panic and I didn't realize. But eventually I saw Phish that night. But my first real show was in Providence in February 1993. It was the show where they debuted Sample in a Jar. And I remember so well the Mike's Groove, where they did, and they don't do this much, or didn't keep doing it. They did a strobe light with full dry ice. So the whole stage is dry ice, and they're on the trampolines with the strobe light, and you don't even see them jumping.
You
just
freeze
see
them in air.
Yeah.
Wow.
I do
remember that. I remember that a few times.
It was the trippiest thing I ever did.
You don't even have to do drugs to be completely flipped out.
You don't have to. It was so, like, I had that moment that I think every Phish fan has had where you're just like, you're not the same person. You've heard music and seen music in a completely different way. And
right.
I got so into Phish at that point, and my buddy Larry Chasnoff also, that we were just like, we were instant junkies, and we then overheard a guy in the Brown newspaper office talking about Phish, and we like ran in and we're like, what do you know? And he had this tremendous tape collection, and Locke copied a bunch of tapes, and Locke had this encyclopedic knowledge of Phish. And so we became good friends. So cut to 3 years later, Larry and I, we want to do something. We want to do something cool around Phish, I had gotten like a Helping Friendly book in a parking lot, just somebody like had printed out set list. And this is 1995. Not everybody's on the web.
Nothing's really online yet.
Very little.
Right.
You have to kind of be techie.
You have to know where to find it, like on rec.music.fish or something wacky. Right.
Exactly. And if you're not inclined for that kind of thing, you're not.
You probably still worked on paper or just, you know, friends, word of mouth and stuff like that.
It's, yeah, like reading the back of a tape is how you find out about Phish set lists.
Right.
And so I thought this was the coolest thing, that, you know, you could get all these set lists. And Locke had the idea of, like, what about a book of stories? What about people's Phish tales? I think that was our original name, was Phish Tales.
Nice.
And we're like, well, let's marry the two. Let's get the information alongside the personal stories. And Locke was a big set list geek also.
Right.
A very good writer. And he compiled a lot of stuff from both Phishnet and also some of his own research.
We should say that Phish.net, sort of the people that founded that in a way, had already kind of begun work getting this archive, this incredible thing, onto the web and into electronic form.
They had done incredible work. And I should acknowledge that in the early days of the Almanac, it was controversial because we were pulling from a lot of that work.
I see.
And you know, my hat's off to everybody. We could not have done the book had they not done a lot of this work. We did a lot on our own too,
right.
But the real basis of it came from all this great work that people had done collectively online.
Right. And they hadn't yet come out with a companion.
No.
You guys kind of were the first to bring this into printed light altogether.
Very much so, yeah. And we were making it really accessible. And I remember meeting with John Paluska, the manager of the band, and what he said to us, he said what he liked about what we're doing is that we take the folklore and made it accessible to everybody. And when Phish was growing so much in this period, 1995 to 1997, there was, you know, you had so many new people coming in.
Yeah.
And we wanted to create a book that really made you an instant expert and really made you feel connected to what it meant to be a Phish fan.
It was one of those bands where there was so much meaning kind of hidden, not only in every song, and I'm kind of patting myself on the back there, but also in the way the set lists are constructed, but also with what they played the night before and the night before that. And there's patterns and stuff, and seeing it on paper kind of gives everyone almost a little bit of the key to unlock the mystery. And there's, you know, as far as you want to research and dig with Phish, there was always more to find out.
Always more.
So there was a hunger for your book.
So much so. It was such an exciting time. We come out with this very unimpressive staple together thing, and just people couldn't get enough of it, and we're getting calls from all over the country, including from yourself. We heard from, I think, Paige's parents faxed us
nice.
To ask for more copies.
Did they fax you money too?
I think we comp them. I'm pretty sure we comp them. You know, and it was the beginning of a wild ride. And as you said, it was endless. So we had our first volume out that fall of 95. And then in 96, I think we put out volume 2 and 3.
May have been like slightly bound at this point. They still looked like a magazine, but they had now a harder cover.
Volume 2, we were getting there. It had a
magazine cover, slightly thicker stock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a beautiful cover art by Chris DeLeo. And we were getting there. By volume 2, we had sort of gone pro.
Right.
And one of the ways we set this all up was in that fall of 95, when we had this just very base thing. We went around. We went to a lot of shows in fall of 95. And blessed to have seen Quadrophenia at... Rosemont Horizon and so many great shows. But we would go around during set break and we'd just walk up to random people and say, hey, what's the name of the hippie store in your town? What's the name of the like head shop? People would first look at us funny, but then they'd like want to play along and they'd be like, yeah, like Golden Road or Joe's Pipes.
Now and Then in New Hope.
Now and Then in New Hope was a good one. One of our best.
Yeah.
So many of these stores, We pulled together this massive list, hundreds and hundreds of names of hippie stores.
So it wasn't just conversational. This was your business mind at work here.
Totally.
And
so we had this list of hundreds, and then we would just call information. What's the number for Now and Then in New Hope? And then we'd call Now and Then New Hope and tell us about our book, and they would order on the spot.
Wow.
Because Fish was blowing up. This was also the year that Jerry passed. So.
Right.
These stores, they were switching over to Fish very rapidly in terms of their products. And we were this
the torch was being passed, at least merch-wise.
Very much so.
Wow.
Very much so. That's the backdrop for all of this, is that just Fish Nation as we know it, as this bigger thing.
Came alive in 95?
It totally did.
So the fish economy sort of was born around then.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, were you sort of like, how much of your mind was thinking this is a profitable thing for me versus this is kind of a cool thing to do?
Well, it was definitely, I was excited to like launch a business and try to like have it be a cool, profitable thing.
Right.
But this was all like passion. Like it was those early years, we did nothing but work on the almanac all day long. We worked on the almanac.
I know the feeling. Yeah. I absolutely know the feeling with Under the Scales.
Yeah. Like, and when a project is new, you have this endless energy for it.
Yeah.
So I'm sure at the time I was excited to make money, but to be honest, we put all the money in the bank, and to this day I have no idea how much we made. We didn't have like accounting or anything. We had no idea.
You just put it in and then you probably used it for the next one.
Yeah. And the best part though was that when we would go to shows, our rule was that if you would go to shows and sell almanacs, whatever money you took in, you could spend on tour. So Chasnoff and I would go on tour. The other guys didn't really. And it never cost us a penny to go on tour. And we never sold on the parking lots because we just wanted to be respectful to the band in that regard.
Right.
But we would sell at rest stops. And we would stop at the Turnpike and there'd be hundreds of Fish fans before a show. And we'd walk in with like a stack of 20 bucks and we'd walk out with $300. And at the time, I was a kid. I was 24. That was so much money. $300. Yeah. Oh my God, I can't spread. We didn't stay in hotels. We stayed on friends' couches.
Right.
Like $300 was so much money. And whatever money we had when we got home, we would just throw into the almanac kind of
bank piggy bank.
Yeah, exactly. So we were sharing it with our partners, but we got to,
you got to take the tour expenses out.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I learned that if you make the right life choices, you never have to pay for tour. So,
I must have made the right life choice somewhere, deciding to write for the band.
I think we both did, Tom. I think no regrets.
No regrets. Please, me, have no regrets. So as you moved along through the almanac, a competing book came out called The Companion. And was that a thing or what happened? Like, what happened there?
Well, by the time The Companion came out, we were really almost done.
Oh, okay. Volume 6.
Yeah, we were on Volume 6, which was done by a group of guys out of Atlanta. A guy named Kevin Castles put a group together. So we did 5 volumes.
Okay.
The 5th one was actually through a major publisher, and that was fun. We got a publishing deal.
Oh, nice.
Not a big one, but, it was a nice feather in our cap.
Right.
And then these guys took over, Kevin and his crew took over in Atlanta, And that's, I believe, the time The Fish Companion came out. And the one thing that I do remember is that some of the guys who put out The Fish Companion put out some press early on that was very critical of the Almanac and called it names and whatever. And our slogan was the ultimate toilet reading for fans. And they try to kind of make that like a negative, like this is toilet. And it was that's our joke.
Oh, I see.
And it always bothered me because Kevin, who had worked so hard on the book, you know, he wasn't part of any like fish fights. I'll acknowledge that the people who were upset with us in terms of the set list, I think they had a legit gripe.
Right.
I think what we were doing was really positive. Information can't be copyrighted. We certainly didn't do anything like legally wrong.
Right.
But I get that their project was one that was born entirely out of wanting something for the community and keeping it totally nonprofit.
Volunteer based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were coming in as sort of outsiders and saying, okay, we're going to create a little enterprise around this. I get it. Their criticism was not, you could debate both sides.
I see.
I think people did. So when the Companion came out and they were so openly critical of the Almanac, and Kevin had just come out with this beautiful, he did such a good job of Volume 6, I felt really bad about that because that was not a battle that he had done anything.
I see.
You know.
He sort of inherited a weird battle.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I think that, you know, over time, God, these are nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So all those wounds are healed.
Yes, good.
And I think, you know, hats off.
It's my aim to rip the scars
right.
off.
Yeah. And hats off to the Mockingbird Foundation as a whole.
Of course. Incredible.
Know, yeah. They've just done so many good things.
Millions of dollars to children's education.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that all came out of that. So what I like to say is we pissed those guys so off so much that they got inspired to do their own book, start their own nonprofit, give millions of dollars to kids. So I'm happy to piss people off if that is the result. And I think everybody in retrospect can agree that the fish community has just really benefited from the creativity of a lot of fans.
Yeah, yeah. Now, while we're on the subject, and then I promise there'll be no more about this, but did you get on the wrong side of Amy? Weren't you on the wrong side of Amy once, or is that a different Andy Bernstein?
No, that is me.
Oh, that is you. Yeah.
When I started seeing fish.
So Amy being the, she unwittingly, or I'm not sure exactly why, but she was sort of assigned lot security and was kind of, her particular job. And this is in the early days, folks, was to kind of basically guard fish's copyright. So if a fan were out there misusing or selling something with the word fish or fish's logo on it, she would often just snatch it, like confiscate it.
Oh yeah, with a court order. It was a pretty big thing. And the way it all happened is at one of my first shows, 1993, at Clarkson University, this was in the late spring, and we'd planned to go on summer tour and wanted to sell something. I saw Mike. Mike used to just come and hang with the fans. And I asked Mike, is it okay if we like make some merch? And Mike's like, sure, just don't use the logo. I'm like, all right, we won't use the logo. And don't let Amy catch you.
We should say Amy's last name.
Amy Skelton,
yes.
The first fish fan.
First
and we're like, okay, sure, we just won't let Amy catch us. Now, 20, however many years later, I understand you don't ask the band person if it's okay to make the t-shirt. You
right.
go through management, there are channels, there are ways to not violate a copyright. And I was a kid and I was just like, hey, Mike said it's okay. And you know, and so we came out with a shirt, our own shirt. It said Gone Fishing, and we sold a ton of them.
Right.
And
it doesn't use the logo, but it does violate with the PHISA.
Exactly.
I
yeah.
see.
And after that tour, we learned pretty quickly not to do that. We had other shirts that didn't say the name of the band and things like that. But
right.
the first tour we were breaking the rules. And what I didn't, I was a kid, and
right.
I was like running from Amy was fun.
Oh, okay.
And what I didn't have the understanding of is this is the first fish fan. This person is royalty. This
yeah.
person should be treated with absolute respect at all times. And I got at Magna Ball, I saw Amy for the first time in like 15 years. And I'm just like, I am so sorry.
Really?
And it's not the first time I've apologized to her because I.
How did that go over?
No, fine. I mean, listen, everybody's over this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah.
Nobody is still upset about something that happened in a parking lot in 1993,
right.
is the year we're talking about. But I look back at it, and it's like, you know, I hear it all these years later. We've worked so much with Fish and with management and with all the different bands. And understand the importance of, one, their intellectual property, and two, just being really respectful.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you're a kid, you just don't know that. And it, honestly, if there's one thing that I could tell my young self, it would be to not do that. If I could go back and change one thing, it's that. But all got forgiven very fast.
Yes.
And like, John Peluska was great. And I like to think that people recognize that the Almanac was a truly creative work.
Yeah.
The Almanac was funny. It was well-researched. It was just really well done. And I credit, I'm not patting myself on the back, I credit Lockhart Steele.
Yeah.
I credit all the people who contributed. There was a quality to the Almanac and a soul, and it was funny. And that is probably the point of difference between our book and all the other Phish books, is that we made a point of being funny.
Because it was funny.
Phish is a funny band.
Absolutely. Phish has humor in their core, their spine, in their bones. And everything, all these stories, it seemed to be like not necessarily tongue in cheek, because these are people recounting their actual experiences. And you read these, you know, next to set lists or song histories or something. But it's incredible reading, because you were often at those concerts as well. And seeing someone else recount their experiences that were happening maybe 10 feet from you in the audience or whatever, or later that night, but in that same town or city, it's just incredible, incredibly compelling. And you can just go page by page. And I should know, because on my way into the city today, 1 hour ride from Princeton Junction into New York, I read a lot of Farmer's Almanac Volume 6, which is really intense. I found in my bookshelf. Really cool. And so anyway, I was really excited to kind of find it and crack it again for the first time in probably 10, 15 years.
Yeah, it's, thank you for those kind words. And I'm just looking at it here on the table here. It's not something that sits on my table. but I am really proud of it. And I've talked to Locke about this. And it's not what Locke and I sit around and talk about either. But
right.
When we do, we look at each other. And Locke, who has just, you know, accomplished so much.
You probably high-five each other.
Well, we just both agree that we're really proud of it. We're really proud of the work we did. And we're really proud of how it... the positive impact it had. I'll tell one quick anecdote.
Sure.
I believe it was the year 2000, and Chasnoff, one of the editors, had met his wife to be, and we were at a Disco Biscuits festival, and it's probably 1999. And somebody comes up to us and is telling us how much the Almanac meant to them, and just being so complimentary and so flowing, and we, you know, appreciating it and nodding. And my girlfriend at the time nudges me and looks over at Larry's future wife, Michelle, and she goes, oh, she's never seen this before. This is new for her. Because that used to happen all the time.
Oh, the adulation kind of thing.
All the time. Just the appreciation,
yes,
that we get. And it was just, and it meant something every time.
Of course.
Every time. And I get chills thinking about it. And so.
That's really cool.
That was the payoff in doing the Almanac. The Almanac was hard work.
Yeah.
The payoff was just in knowing that individual people's, the door opened for Phish with them through this book. And that is what a magical thing to do for somebody else.
You did. This was sort of like the, you know, the portal. Like we talked about before, we unlocked some of the mystery, and that's a great thing. Well, anyway, congrats on that, Andy. Moving a little bit forward, I already kind of commented on your name, Andy Bernstein. In this very office, we're sitting actually in the Relics office. Headcount shares space in New York City with Relics. Steve Bernstein is no relation to you, is he? Because he was the original guy in Relics when my band Amphibian had a Relics record deal with them, sort of. They were our publisher.
We are not related.
Okay.
I do want to commend him on putting out Amphibian. I think Amphibian is great, by the way. I saw you guys at the Wetlands.
Thank you.
As I recall, you played Farmhouse. It was a big moment.
Yeah, definitely. We covered some Phish.
You have license to. But yeah, no, Headcount, we share space with Relics Magazine, and now Pete Shapiro is sitting in that office that Steve Bernstein used to sit in, and Pete is a good friend and board member. But yeah, my name has... It's been a journey with my name. I
know a lot of Andys too.
There's a lot of Bernsteins out there.
And a lot of Bernsteins.
In the early days of the Disco Biscuits, there was a crew guy named Eric Bernstein, and everybody referred to him as Bernstein. So I'd sort of lost that. I wasn't Bernstein anymore. And then Andy Gadiel, with his Phish page, started becoming pretty prominent in our scene, and he kind of became Andy. So I became a first name, last name guy. And then a dude shows up named Andy Bernstein, who's a Biscuit fan and all over the like Biscuits message boards. And so I didn't really have.
First, you lost your last name, then you lost your first name, then you lost your full name.
I got nothing. I've been trying to build it back ever since.
It's kind of funny how there are like two Scott Bernsteins really closely attached to the scene. And so anyway, no relation there. There was a time in my not so far away past where I didn't like thinking about politics, and especially didn't like thinking about my band as a political band. So seeing a headcount thing there, I guess, is cool. You know, people should register. You wanted there to be a musical tie-in in some way, clearly, right?
Oh, yeah. It started, the way it started was that I was a reporter. I was working as a reporter. So I didn't do anything with music for a living. And I did an interview with somebody. This is late 2003, when it's the height of the Iraq War. And the interview kind of turned to politics. And when I was done with it, I put the phone down and I said, I got to stop complaining and I got to do something. What can I do? And I just sort of had this little conversation with myself staring at my computer. And
you were angry with the America's our involvement in the Iraq War.
Yeah. And what I was particularly angry about was Guantanamo Bay. Like, I'm a civil liberties guy, and I thought that no matter what people are accused of, or
due process.
Yeah, that's something I really believe in, and I think that's a very nonpartisan thing, or should be.
Yeah.
And so that was what that conversation was about. So I was all amped up about it and thought about it and said, oh, you know, if I can just get people to vote who go to the same concerts I do, that's maybe how I can make a difference.
Hmm.
And this is after, you know, in Florida, it was, what, 535 votes were the difference. And we know that Fish shows are a lot bigger than that, as are Dead shows and Disco Biscuit shows and all of these.
Right.
So I have the idea, and I write this long email and kind of laying out the whole plan. And I send it to Mark Brownstein of the Disco Biscuits, who I grew up with. And Mark returns it with two words: I'm in.
Wow.
And we just got started. And then Mark reached out to Al Schneer of Moe.
Yeah.
To be an original board member. And Al reached out to Bob Weir, who he'd met a couple times. They jammed together. And Bobby got involved from day one. So really, in the early days of Headcount, Fish was more off kind of in the distance there.
Yeah.
But Bobby and Rat Dog then were integrally involved from day one. And we started out with a group of bands that was Michael Fronti and Assembly of Dust and Derek Truck's band and, you know, some still very familiar names that have been a big part of the scene. And the idea was that we would just register voters at concerts. And it took off very quickly. We had street teams in about 50 cities within really a few months.
And it was never your goal to, say, get Democrats to sign up. It was just register, civic duty kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, we decided from day one this is going to be nonpartisan. People don't need us to tell them how to vote.
Right.
But clearly, you know, there are a lot of people who aren't voting. And can we make it easy? Can we make it the social norm? Can we encourage it? And that first year was really magical, because as amped up as America is right now about politics, I always say that 2004 was the really big year. During the Bush-Kerry, there was a huge increase in turnout that year. It went from, I think, 36% of young voters in the Bush-Gore to 47%. For Kerry Bush. And it's kind of stayed there ever since. It's still a low number. It's still half of America.
Right.
But it had gone to an extreme low in 2000. And so in 2004, artists were really engaged. This was the thing that people just really clicked with. It was like, yeah, everybody's got to vote. Whoever you vote for, everybody's got
to
vote.
Kind of harkens back to the, like, almost the 60s and like music and musicians used to get political. They used to, you know, end the Vietnam War, for example, stuff like that, protests and stuff. It doesn't seem like musicians are really kind of taking the cause anymore. But this, in a way, operates on that fringe, the leftover fringe of the 60s movement.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, in everything that we ever wrote about it in the beginning, it was about that. Like, you know, cultural movements, political movements historically come out of music. And now we've got technology at our disposal. We have all these different ways of organizing it. Let's do it better than anybody's done it before.
Interesting.
And yeah, and that was really our mantra. I mean, we were really, Hunter S. Thompson had said, if every deadhead in Florida had voted, the world would be a different place. And
he was talking about Nixon back then, right?
No, he was talking about Bush Gore.
Oh.
535 votes.
Oh, okay.
And so that was inspiring to us, and put the partisan implications aside, just the idea that we can make a difference, we can be the difference. Because, you know, Bonnaroo, which is just starting back then, 70,000 people, it's impossible to look at that and not think, okay, there's power here.
Yeah.
And that year, so what ended up happening is all this stuff comes together, and then sure enough, Phish did want to get involved, and as did Dave Matthews Band, which we didn't see coming, because that's a little bit of a bigger world than the world that I knew.
Right.
We actually went on the road with Phish, the Dead, and Dave Matthews that summer, and then at Bonnaroo, we recorded television commercials, public service announcements.
Wow.
With Trey and with everybody in the Dead and with Dave Matthews, and They're on our YouTube page. Like, I'm actually really proud of these ads.
That's great.
If you search probably Headcount Trey Anastasio YouTube, you'll probably find it.
Right.
And those commercials ended up running on network TV. I knew the head of TNT and TBS.
Right.
And he ran them all day long.
Awesome.
Like, you could sit and watch, CSI. I'm watching.
Yeah, okay, right, yeah.
And Law and Order. That was the big one. So that was really exciting. And that was like, you know, that was one of the first interactions we had with Trey. It was the first interaction we had with Trey for Headcount. And to your point about Phish not being a political band, the person who feels...
Well, I'd say three of them are not political, or at least want to be neutral.
As a band, they are not political.
Okay, right.
And Trey, I think, is the one who feels most strongly about that, or at least is kind of articulates it the most. He does not want to divide...
Yes.
Music should unite everyone.
Right. I believe, and sorry to interrupt you, I believe it was it Howard Dean maybe at the time of Vermont, at the time possibly on his way to becoming senator or something, asked Phish to play. And I think sort of the power of Vermont was kind of saying, do it. And Trey or maybe management or maybe the whole band together kind of, it seemed like they wanted to do it. And yet they decided against, simply for the philosophy that you were just beginning to say before I interrupted you, which was politics divides, music unites.
Yeah, and I think it also dates back to the show, the For Choice show, which was probably 95.
Was that the one in Lowell?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there. And that one definitely, that's not like a voting thing. That was more just like abortion rights kind of thing.
Right. And from what I've heard, the band afterward felt like it was the last time they were ever going to do that.
Okay.
That it was, they didn't want to be taking sides.
Okay.
And so Headcount comes out and we're not taking sides. We're kind of, there's this sort of universal value of participation, and that's what we're pushing. And I'm very grateful that all the guys in the band were very open-minded to that, and including Trey. And I think that Trey has always sort of struggled with that and gone back and forth. But
yes.
He did. He was great on the set of the PSA. Just great.
Right.
We had a blast with him. And when we shot that PSA, one of the scenes was 70,000 people with their arms in the air.
Nice.
And to get that shot, Al from Mo had to cue up the entire crowd. Mo was playing to this, you know, probably their biggest set ever was that Bonnaroo set in 2004. And Al, bless his soul, cues up the entire crowd for our cameras to be in this commercial.
Put their hands in the air.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was an amazing moment to be on stage for. And then right after that, we went and filmed Trey. And we told Trey the story. We were all so excited. And then I look at Trey and say, you know, I don't know if you know what it feels like to be on stage in front of 70,000 people with their arms in the air. And he laughed hard. It was a great moment. And I, you know, I'm really grateful to the guys in the band, because it's not natural for them. There are very political artists where getting behind Headcount is just a very obvious thing. And I think that Phish has always kind of gone back and forth with all that stuff. But Beth in the Phish office, and Waterwheel, and Maddie Beck, and all of them, they've found a place for Headcount. They've found a place for us in the Phish community.
Nice.
And it's so important, because I think roughly half of our volunteers are Phish fans.
Wow.
And so it is just really, really important to the whole operation of what we're doing. So to be able to go this year to Baker's Dozen and set up every night, and we had a Vote Local photo booth with all these cool like cutouts, and we actually had cutouts of Mike Gordon and John Fishman holding up our Vote Local signs.
I've seen some of those photos, some of the results of those. I was kind of wondering, I never found it. In my hike around the perimeter at MSG, I didn't find the booth, but I saw the photos. They were great.
It was really fun. It was awesome. And all of Baker's Dozen was incredible.
Do volunteers get anything like tickets, for example?
They get to go into the show. So okay. It's not usually a hard ticket. Once in a while, there's hard tickets involved. But whether it's Fish or Dead and Company or Portugal the Man or any of the... Right now, we're out on the road with War on Drugs, and we're going to be out on the road with Grizzly Bear. When I say out on the road, it means we're actually traveling people from show to show, which we'll do when we're doing a larger thing. And we've done that with Fish a ton over the years.
Okay.
We work with Ben and Jerry's a lot and the Waterwheel Foundation. We've given out free ice cream in the parking lot to just get a crowd together and get people registered. So we've had a really, really special run with Fish. And then, of course, obviously, John Fishman is, a very vocal Bernie supporter. But Fish running for office is just what a wonderful example of how to take matters into your own hands.
Right. Rather than get mad on the internet, he actually went and did something about it. And now he's a selectman or whatever in his county in Maine.
And it really is inspiring.
It's amazing.
Can you imagine what those meetings are like when they're deciding where to put
really
the stop sign?
I don't really know what a selectman does, but he definitely is one. You can tell he is.
It's and that's, there's a big movement out there for people to run for office. There's a group out there called Run for Something.
I thought I was going to say that could be your next project.
Well, we work with organizations that are doing that. Run for Something they have a more of a partisan bent than we do, so we're not directly aligned with them in any way. But their numbers are really impressive. They've gotten over 10,000 people to sign up to run for office.
Here's a cynical question. Do you operate primarily in blue states?
We really operate wherever we have the volunteers and where the shows are. So, we have a team in Birmingham, Alabama. We have teams all over Texas. But really, people the question that people ask a lot is, do you focus on swing states? And I say, we do the best job we can do everywhere.
Right.
So we're not trying harder in one state than the other because we're really giving it our all.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, in a way, you can appear nonpartisan but be partisan if you only, work kind of like gerrymandering or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and people try to catch us, quote unquote, catch us all the time being partisan. And I was like, anybody who is behind the scenes knows that we have so many things we care about deeply. We don't have time to be sneaky.
No. Okay.
We're really, really trying to do the best job that we can. But what we know for sure is that our music community tends to be fairly progressive. It's not as monolithic as people think. There are the majority of young white people in America voted for Trump. So it's not as if there's this, you go to a Fish show and there aren't people who voted for every party and everything. And it's a wonderful diversity. And hopefully you can have good conversations and you can have disagreements and you bond around the music. Yep. And you can respect somebody whose views you disagree with.
Right.
Because you're the same in your soul in a way.
Maybe.
Well, I always, I think your musical taste is an imprint of your soul. Much more than your political leanings, I think.
Good call. Yeah.
And I think that music can be a bridge, and if you can rock out to an antelope, you can at least have a respectful conversation about your differing viewpoints.
Agreed.
And so in the end, what we are trying to do is be uniting, and if we ever did have some sort of partisan agenda, for one thing, our trolls on the internet would call us out so fast. What's up, Keith Shirley? It's our favorite troll.
Super troll.
Yeah, super troll. And I'm grateful to Keith Shirley because he just calls us out on everything.
Right.
But every time we read this stuff, we try to say, does he have a point here?
Right.
Usually he does not. Sorry, Keith. But every once in a while he does. And we're like, huh, yeah, we kind of missed that. Because you always have your own biases that you bring into anything.
Well, that's kind of funny. So one of the techniques I learned for podcasting is when I need to ask a question about should I do something or not, I kind of create this avatar in my head of whom I'm speaking with. And mine actually has my brain goes to a person that I know. His name's Ryan. Shout out Ryan Stanley. But you guys in a way have a negative avatar. So you like, you probably, can judge, you know, you make some decisions based on what he thinks as well.
Yeah. And it is really helpful, and I'm probably giving him way too much time because he is a shameless troll, but, one thing that I feel very strongly about is our integrity and our authenticity does come down to being nonpartisan. That if it's ever a wink, wink, if we're ever playing a game, then the whole thing is viewed as being bogus, and authenticity is your greatest value.
Yep.
So what we try to do is really, really always start every conversation with, you know, is there anything in this that could be perceived as partisan, and go from there. And we've had, I think some of our best moments of an organization are when we really are looking at the whole spectrum of ideas. We did a thing with Bob Weir 5 years ago now called the Bridge Session, where we paired Bobby with members of The National at his studio, at TRI Studios. They played a two-set show that was webcast live. And then in between sets, we had a political conversation that included Republicans and Democrats.
Wow.
And it's still online. And it led, of course, to Bobby recording an album with the guys in The National.
That's amazing.
But the Bridge Session stuff and the conversations is all out there. And that's when I feel really, really good about what we're doing. One, when we're adding to the creativity. I mean, the fact that Bobby ended up recording an album that started with that session is mind-blowing.
That is.
But the fact that we were able to create this dual political conversation is really important.
Speaking of Bobby, you guys auctioned a guitar off at the Fare Thee Well. Is that right?
Yeah. That's a big part of Headcount's history and really our recent history. At Fare Thee Well.
And what was that guitar?
It was a guitar that was a commemorative guitar that Bobby played on stage during one of the first shows.
Oh, okay.
And we auctioned it throughout the entire 5-show run. And by the end, a couple guys really went at it, bidding. And it ended up going for $526,000. And that money got split among the nonprofits at Fare Thee Well. There were 17 organizations that got $32,000 each. And that was something that Headcount built. It's called Participation Row. And this is the other big aspect of the organization right now, is we organize multiple nonprofits at festivals, on concert tours. We're out with War on Drugs and coming up Grizzly Bear soon. We'll do Dead & Co. again. And we just have this whole other wing of our organization where we're organizers and we're bringing out this all the organizations and creating an experience. And part of it is the auctions where we raise a lot of money for all the different groups.
That's amazing. And I've kept you a long time here, Andy, and I really appreciate it. But one thing that you and I spoke about when we set up this interview was this recent Fish and Race article that had come out. Do you want to fill me in a little bit there? Because I saw it, but I didn't realize the blowback you had gotten on it.
Sure. So on Headcount's blog, we put out an article about a few weeks ago about diversity or lack thereof in the fish scene. And it was written by a very, very sharp guy named Adam Liaz, who is an attorney in D.C. who works for a progressive think tank.
Was it racial diversity or also sex? Because it favors white males, kind of.
He wrote another article about gender that we haven't run yet.
Okay.
But he wrote one about diversity, and I read the piece, and I just thought the piece was great.
Okay.
Because the piece didn't call anybody racist by any means.
Right.
It just, the theme of the piece was, let's be aware of the fact, let's acknowledge the fact that this is not a very diverse community.
Right.
And let's also be very aware of the experiences of people of color, of people who do bring diversity to our scene, because you may think you know what their experience is like, but it might be a little different. And he interviewed several people who said very different things. Some said, this is the most inclusive community I've ever been a part of. But some of the anecdotes were a little disturbing. One person said, I'm constantly asked where the bathroom is, even when I'm wearing a Grateful Dead t-shirt.
Wow.
And things like that, you know, you're like, God, that stinks that somebody has that experience in our loving community.
Yeah.
And so I thought this was a very positive message. It just kind of points out to people, just, you know, puts this idea on the radar that people might not be thinking about.
Right.
And I thought the tone of the piece was really spot on.
Right.
Well, oh man, it shows what I know.
You were off.
I was way off because we got so much negative reaction on our Facebook page and on fish message boards. Vitriol, people just being like, really, how could you even bring this up? Like, why do you have to make everything about race? Why do you have to make everything political? And a lot of white people saying, this is the most inclusive community there is. But one thing that I saw with the comments was over half a dozen fish fans of color posted in support of the article. And it was very validating, but it really showed me that there is a divide even in our own scene that is representative of what's happening in America, where you have very, very different views on race, often based on what someone's race is. And I think as fish fans and as people who have been blessed to be part of something so special and so community-oriented, it is not too much to ask of any of us that we just stop for a second, acknowledge that we don't look like America. America is a very diverse country. We are much whiter. And think about it for a second. Think whatever you want to think about it. And just be aware that when people of color come to fish, like, be as inclusive as you can be and try to not treat people any different, because the theme was, I don't want to be treated differently. And so I think a lot of good came out of the article, because we sure as hell did create a conversation. But it was very shocking to me, the level of negativity. And some of it just really had a real nasty streak to it.
Okay. Well, that is something to think about. And my eyes are open as well.
Yeah, and that's all we can ask of ourselves, is just, you know, open our own eyes to other people's experiences and to ours. And I do believe that our community, the fish scene and the jam scene, we really have, there's so much good, like so much good. And, and it's the fundamental values. It's love thy neighbor. It's, I feel like it's ingrained in the Grateful Dead's music and that whole experience and then fish and all of us, like, I think that we as a community can contribute in a huge way, whether it's what the Mockingbird Foundation has done or Headcount has done or Waterwheel or all, just us all as people. And we can, when the country is going through so many negative things, we can be a force of positive light. But we also have to be able to look at ourselves and understand that we have work to do, too.
Evaluate, like, and change all the time.
There's nothing, and this is a point the article made, there's nothing inherently wrong with the fact that the fish community isn't that diverse. But let's at least just think about it, and let's at least always be working in our own lives to make the world as positive a place as we can be. And in some ways, that's welcoming people to our scene. And in some ways, it's voting. In some ways, it's being environmental. And I've been blessed to be able to kind of do this as a life and and take just this incredible thing that we have, a band called Fish, and all the things that it means to so many people, and just be able to create on top of it and give back in some ways and get back so much more.
That's a perfect way to end this interview, Andy, because, you know, I was trying to come up with a way of summarizing how you have given back so much, you know, from, you've gotten a lot from the music, obviously, and you've given back a lot. And that's like the best kind of fan, and really great talking to you. I have to ask, because it's my standard quintessential under the scales question. How many shows have you been to?
It's about 300, and I did lose count.
Well, can you round up? I mean, can you round up to 300 safely, do you think?
Yeah, I'm within 10 of it. okay. I know my 100th was Corte Maggiore, Italy, in 1997. The last 200 were a little bit of a blur.
I was there, too. I was there for that one.
Were you?
I was there at your 100th. I don't know if it was my 100th, but that's awesome. That's great. Well, Andy.
What's your number?
330, 335
range. There was a time when 100 was a big deal.
Yes.
Now it's like you're a beginner. That's cute.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of my reason for asking the question of several interviewees was that I had this theory that there was a number, and like you say, at one point it was 100, above which everyone knew each other. And I was wondering if that number now is 300, meaning we've been shoulder to shoulder at so many shows. Do we at least know each other all by face? And I believe the number might even be higher now.
I think it's higher than that. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who have been to 300, and I can't say I know all of them.
I think the number's wrong. I think it's 400. It might be 400. That might be the new mark.
That's the elite.
We have to limbo under that.
You and I, we're advanced intermediates.
We are. All right. On that note, thanks so much. And thanks for listening to Under the Scales. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, everybody. I have a special announcement. There is one more episode in October. After that, Under the Scales will have been operational for 12 months. My first episode was the day before the election on November 7th, 2016. Since then, I've been honored to have been able to distract you from politics a little. I've spoken to so many amazing guests, including, of course, Trey Anastasio. Counting the upcoming episode, I will have released 36 episodes. That's 3 episodes per month for 12 months. It's been an amazing year. I've learned an incredible amount. I knew nothing about podcasting a year ago. Now I've gotten over 1 million downloads, and I'm extremely proud of that. Thank you all for tuning in and for all your support and fantastic comments and ideas and encouragement. So I want to announce that at the end of October, after the next episode, Under the Scales Season 1 will be ending. Season 2 will be a slightly different format. I'm still a one-man show, and creating 3 episodes per month was a full-time job. Actually more than full-time, and expensive. And my real-life demands on my time have just increased dramatically. Under the Scales isn't going anywhere, don't worry. I'm still going to podcast and continue to interview amazing people in the fish scene and do deep dives into fish-related topics. Only I'm no longer going to stay on a predefined schedule. My website, underthescales.com, and Twitter and Facebook page will instead announce whenever a new episode is released. I have 2 band members ready to talk to me imminently, and I'm working on a multi-part, very musical mini-series of episodes. I also will have an exclusive reveal of an amazing project for you guys, hopefully early next year. I'm crazy excited about that and all these upcoming projects. Because my emphasis won't be on speed or quantity anymore, the quality of my podcast will go up. At least it certainly should, I hope. So thanks for an amazing first year. Tune in to the season finale episode on October 23rd and stay tuned at the end, and I'll fill you in a little bit more about the next season of Under the Scales.